In for public broadcasting.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, the Trump administration is proposing some changes to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, that would weaken protection from people with pre-existing conditions. We're going to talk about that later on in the program. But first, the Early Learning Coalition of Pinellas County has begun an initiative to ensure that all children in the county are ready for kindergarten by the time they start. And they've started a project called Thrive by Five Pinellas. And joining us now is Kate Bauer Jones, who is former president and CEO of the United Way of the Florida Keys, who now heads the local Thrive by Five project. And Kate, welcome to WMNF. Nice to meet you.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
All Thanks right. So you're trying to get kids ready for kindergarten.
We are.
I didn't know kids. Well, I guess I did. But tell us, why do kids have to be ready for kindergarten?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because, you know, we all kind of think intuitively, yeah, babies are learning and exploring lots of things, but they're just being babies. And then they don't really start learning until we put them in school. But when you start thinking a little bit more about that, there is a lot of learning, and brain science has really helped us discover that our babies, our little ones, do most, or all of us actually, you and me and everyone listening, most of our brain development happens in the first 3 years of life. We're actually born with all of the neurons that we will ever have in our whole lives. And then in the first 3 years of life, our brain builds those neural connections. And so that time is really, really important for brain development and for all of the learning that we're going to do the whole rest of our lives. And as we've learned, as the brain science has developed and we've learned more and more about our babies and our little ones, it's become more and more clear that we need to do a really good job for all little kids, making sure that they grow up in environments where their brains are able to develop so that by the time they get to kindergarten, they have kind of that the architecture in place and the foundation in place so that their brains are able to develop so that they can learn. And, you know, we hear a lot in schools, you hear a lot in the news about, you know, reading on grade level or high school graduation. And sometimes depending on how involved you are in the education community, you know, maybe the colleges, you've heard people talk about, oh, kids graduating high school don't have the skills to do well in college. And the high schools will say, oh, well, they come out of middle school and they're not prepared. And it kind of goes all the way down. And our kindergarten teachers are saying, you know, the kids are coming through the door and they're so wildly different in what they're able to do. And you have a kid coming into kindergarten who can already read, and you have a kid coming into the same classroom with the same teacher who's never held a book before in their life. And so what we're trying to do over in Pinellas County with Thrive by Five is make sure that all of our kids get through the door of kindergarten really equipped with everything they need to be successful. So not just the books, not just the reading, but also the social emotional skills. So can they play well with other kids? Can they listen to an adult? Can they run around and have fun on the playground and not hurt themselves and not hurt someone else? And are our families equipped? Do our families have the books in their homes that they need and that they want to have for their kids? Is the community able to support our little ones? Do we have all of the appropriate things in place to make sure that our little guys are getting all they need for their brains to develop so that when they get to kindergarten, they're really ready to learn? And that's what we're trying to do with Thrive by Five.
So if 85% of our brain development happens in those first 3 years of life, what do you do? What does a parent do to make sure that their kids are developing at their brains at an optimum level?
You ready for it?
Yeah.
Talk.
It's
talk
that
to
simple.
Your kid. It's that simple. It really is. Talk to your kid. Sing to your kid. Ask your baby questions. You know, little tiny babies. I have a younger sister in Tampa who is pregnant. She's going to be having a baby in the fall, in the winter. And, you know, I feel bad for my sister. I feel bad for this baby because they're getting it already. And it's, you know, you talk. And when they're very first born and you're changing diapers, you sing to them. You expose them to language. Our brains are wired to learn through listening, through looking at the world around them. And so you ask your baby questions, you tell them what the answers are. There are studies that show, and it's It's a little bit shocking, but families that are more well-educated, that understand this brain science, that have learned all these things about child development, they talk to their babies, and a lot of times that educational attainment is tied to economic status. So higher income households, those babies, by the time they hit 3 years old, have heard 30 million more words in their babyhood, in their childhood. And so the thing that we tell people, the easiest and the most important and the most effective thing you can do is talk to your baby. That's it. Their brains will develop. They just need to be exposed to the language. They need to be talked to. They need to be engaged with. And that's how we develop their brains.
And what about the tone? I mean, you know, some people, unfortunately, some kids misbehave. Just I'm wondering about the importance of tone when you talk to kids.
I would say I think it's hard for a little one. When we're talking about our little guys under three, I don't know that a lot of them are misbehaving. I would say that they're exploring and they haven't learned all the rules yet. One of the other things that we're trying to do, though, because there are some little ones that have, maybe we're talking about developmental issues, maybe we're talking about neurological conditions. And so part of what we want to be able to do also is get families connected to care, be able to identify those babies that really do have developmental issues that need something extra. There's not a lot of two-year-olds that are misbehaving, but maybe they're acting in a way that isn't developmentally appropriate because they have undiagnosed autism or something like that. So if we can get our little ones connected to care, get them treatment when they're really young, then we can help them all the way down the line. Or even things that are as simple as, you know, a little one in a early learning center that isn't engaging with the teacher, and why is that 2-year-old always acting out at story time? Maybe they can't see. So we get them some glasses, and you can make a world of difference for a little one at a very young age. And we think that they're not behaving well, but maybe there's another issue that we need to identify so that we can give them the tools to be successful.
So getting back to the well-behaved kids, who are mostly well-behaved kids. So 0 to 3, talk to your kids, sing them songs, read books to them.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
How do you tell you're on track? I mean, if some kids hear 30 million fewer words by the time they're three, and then they are at a permanent disadvantage long term, perhaps. How do you make sure that you're on track?
Well, I don't think that you can do assessments, but I don't think you need to. I don't think all of that. If you have a typically developing child, so you don't have a little one with some sort of medical issue that they need an intervention, then I think that, you know, our parents that are paying attention, that want to be educating their children, they will be talking to their kids. They'll be taking them to the library. There are a lot of resources where you can give your little one access to story time. Thrive by Five Pinellas Initiative is kind of living in the Early Learning Coalition. And so no matter a family's income level, or no matter a family's ability to pay for all of kind of the fancy extras, you know, one of the neat things that's being in the Early Learning Coalition is that we have the resources for our low-income families. So if you have to work, if you don't have time to sit around all day and talk to your child, and you need help putting your kid in care, we can help with that too. We have resources in the community that will make sure that our little ones have access to care, that they can be in environments where they're talked to. Treating our early learning teachers, our youngest children's teachers, in classrooms and informal settings like the professionals that they are, and equipping them with the tools that they need to teach the babies too, that's a huge part of it. So the Early Learning Coalition has a professional development institute for, you know, baby teachers, and that's incredibly important for the whole community.
Just getting back to this idea of keeping on track, I wonder if just simply reading a book a night, a children's book a night to a child, keeps you on track.
Yep, and reading them their favorite book over and over again.
That helps?
It does. It really does. It helps with language development, because when you repeat things, that repetition helps the those neural pathways that are developing when they're really little. And so, you know, with your little one, I had a meeting this morning, I was talking to a colleague, and she has a 10-month-old, and she said, we read Brown Bear, Brown Bear every night to her 10-month-old, because that repetition is so important, and that exposure and that love, that affinity for books, teaching little ones, you know, a 10-month-old is not reading, but a 10-month-old is learning that that time with mom and dad at the end of the day is good and important and precious, and that's associated with a book, and that's associated with language development and all of those messages. That's all of that is teaching a child, and that's incredibly important too.
Well, we're talking with Kate Bauer-Jones, who's Director of Community Impact at Thrive by Five Pinellas. It's part of the Early Learning Coalition of Pinellas County. A recent report shows that only 57% of Pinellas County children are ready for kindergarten. Children who enter kindergarten with healthy development and the necessary academic skills are more likely to graduate high school and have higher lifelong earnings. 85% of brain development occurs within the first 3 years of life, and most children who enter kindergarten a year or so behind their peers will not have that chance to catch up. Right. So we're talking about the importance of early learning, Thrive by Five, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. So talk to your kids, read to your kids. What other things can we do to get our kids ready for kindergarten?
Well, like I meant, you know, we can treat our early learning educators like the professionals that they are. That's a huge part of it too, is understanding as a community that this isn't just babysitting. It's not daycare. That's, someone told me this years ago. My background, I worked with older kids. I was a teacher. And when I first started working with little kids, someone told me it's not daycare. They're not caring for days. It's childcare. They're caring for children. They're teachers, and treating the folks that are doing this as a profession like professionals and not like babysitters is a huge part of what we're trying to do. You know, one of the pieces of this, because it's really about the whole community, it's about all of us working together to support children. I don't have children. And so there's a little bit of this moment where you go, oh, well, what's this lady without kids doing with this childcare initiative? But I live in this community, and I want to make sure that our children become educated adults. I want to make sure that our entire citizenry, that our entire population is full of thoughtful people who are engaged in their communities. And that, I know that starts with our little ones.
Are all childcare locations, are they all supposed to do some level of teaching to the children that they look over?
That's a really tough question. I will tell you there are two answers to that. I will say my personal belief is yes, everyone working with kids is supposed to be doing some level of learning. However, there's a lot of different types of early childcare. And so we have licensed centers, we have accredited centers, we have gold seal centers, we have informal centers, and the... And our ability, as you know, I'll say from the Early Learning Coalition, our ability to have a part of the quality in those centers depends on the type of center it is.
I wonder how you can judge before you send your child to a child care location. How do you determine which ones are the best when it comes to helping improve their academic performance?
We can certainly tell you as a parent out there, we can, the Early Learning Coalition in Pinellas or in Hillsborough or in Pasco or Manatee or wherever you're listening from, your Early Learning Coalition can tell you which of the providers in your area are credentialed at what level. So if they're a gold seal provider, that's the highest level of accreditation you can get in the state of Florida. And we can tell you which of the centers are gold seal accredited. We can tell you which of the centers are NACE accredited. Accredited, which is a really big deal. That's a national certification. So your Early Learning Coalition is a really great resource if you're looking to identify where are the best sites. But there are a lot of people out there interacting with kids that, you know, childcare is very expensive too, and that's a huge issue. And so making sure that the resources are available so that anyone who is interacting with kids has all the tools, you know, maybe it's very difficult to afford some of those best sites. So you want to leave your little one, you know, maybe you're really lucky and your mom lives nearby and your mom's going to watch your kid. So make sure that your mom is equipped with all of the information. You know, grandmas and grandpas and extended family and all of those informal care networks is what we call them. Making sure that all of those informal care networks have all of those same tools so that they can be taking care of the babies too, no matter how you're plugged in.
Just getting back to the 30 million words, does TV impart word language skills to kids?
I don't have the, I'm going to say not in the same way, no, because we don't interact with, we don't engage with TV or with screens in the same way.
So you've got to engage with.
It's the engagement piece, yes. Yeah. And the national, oh, I'm going to get this wrong. The Academy of Pediatrics, the pediatric doctors says, recommends no screen time at all for kids younger than 2 years of age.
Really?
And then when you do have screen time with your little ones, having the parents with them, working with them in front of the screen. So, you know, in this area, in the Tampa Bay region, we've got some really cool tools. I know there's a program called Mion Reader that's a, it's an online library that you can access on a computer or on a device or whatever. And they're books, and that's wonderful. But if you're doing books with your little ones, particularly your really little ones, as a parent or as a caring adult or as a caregiver, you want to be using that with your, with the child that you're working with, because that interactive piece is so important.
Just getting back to kind of judging child care facilities, the Early Learning Coalition can help you find the better ones? And,
yes.
Okay, so how can people get in touch with the Early Learning Coalition in Pinellas County?
You can go online. Our website is ELC, Early Learning Coalition, so it's elcpinellas.net. And then we have, the webpage is really nice, so if you're a parent and you're looking for a provider, you can click on the big button that says For Parents. If you're a provider and you're listening and you're thinking, boy, I wish I had some of these resources, we have a big button that says For Providers, and it'll give you access to this professional development institute that I mentioned, where we have classes. And there's all kinds of, it's really interesting for our providers that want to increase their skills and increase their knowledge. They're letting me, I am not a child care provider, but at the ELC, they're letting me listen and learn, because one of the interesting pieces of research that's been coming out in the last handful of years is around the effects of trauma on the developing brain. And particularly our little ones that grow up in houses that are suffering from a lot of poverty and the effects of poverty, that has a traumatic effect on the brain. And so we've said, okay, our child care providers need to understand what this does to babies' brains, and then how we can teach them more effectively, how we can teach them better. And so we have at the ELC over in Pinellas County, we have a class coming up for providers on how to do trauma-informed care for our little ones, to make sure that we're helping their brains develop and kind of dealing with the effects of the environment. And so I'm really excited because they're letting me listen in on that class so I can learn that too. But that's the kind of resource that we're providing for our child care teachers out in the community.
Well, our guest is Kate Bauer-Jones. She's the Director of Community Impact, Thrive by Five Pinellas, and that's part of the Early Learning Coalition of Pinellas County. A recent state report shows that only 57% of Pinellas County children were ready for kindergarten. We're talking about how to get your kids ready for kindergarten, including the importance of 30 million words. The other things that parents have to concentrate on, physical health and well-being, social competency, emotional maturity, language that we talked about a lot, and cognitive development, communication, and general knowledge. Those are all things. So that's a lot to get your child ready for before they're 5 years old and they go into kindergarten. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about physical health and well-being for a moment. What kind of things should we keep in mind?
Well, that's paying attention to your baby. So knowing they're the really, really fundamental basics that, you know, all parents are concerned about. So making sure that babies are fed, and, you know, getting them access to healthy food, the nutrition. And we're really fortunate, you know, if a family is struggling, if a mom is struggling, we have programs like WIC, which is a women, infant, and children feeding program, to make sure that the really basics of the nutrition is taken care of. You know, the health. So we have resources in the community like the Healthy Start Coalition. So moms that need help with some of those really basic needs, and maybe, you know, babies aren't born with instruction books. And so if a mom has a new baby and they don't know how to, you know, take care of their little one, we have resources like the Healthy Start Coalition in the community that can help moms learn and understand how to care for their babies. Those things are incredibly important early on. But, you know, you list it all out and it sounds really complicated. Oh my gosh, the emotional and the social and the cognitive and the, but really that's the talking to your baby. That's the engaging. That's the interacting. That's the, you know, you're changing the diaper. So some of the basics, you got to feed your kid. You got to change their diaper because it goes in, it comes out. And that's what little babies are, is in and out. But even at the littlest baby stage, you're changing that diaper and you lift their leg up and you say, I'm lifting your leg up. up now, lift your leg up, and you're talking and you're narrating the process, and they're a month old or they're brand new right home from the hospital, and you're talking to your baby while you're taking care of those really basic physical needs. And right there in that conversation, you're singing to the baby, it's bath time, and you're looking at the belly button and you're touching the toes and you're identifying those body parts. You're doing the cognitive development piece at the exact same time that you're doing the physical care piece, because they all affect each other. And it's that engaging with your baby part that does all the rest of that stuff that sounds really complicated. But if you're talking to your baby and if you're engaging with them, then you're doing those things.
Well, we're talking about how to get your child ready for kindergarten. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and our guest is Kate Bauer-Jones. She is the Director of Community Impact for Thrive by Five Pinellas. And several people are wondering, what are child care providers paid on average? This is really out of your bailiwick, I think, a bit. But they're not paid enough.
I was going to say, I can say with certainty, not enough.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's hard because child care is very expensive. You know, we talked about that paying for child care is hard for a lot of families. It's hugely expensive. I saw something recently about how the average cost of child care is more expensive than college tuition at this point. And then the flip side of that coin is that our child care providers are not paid enough. And we want, I'm thinking about my new little niece coming along in the fall, and I want to make sure that she has a teacher who is the best teacher. And I want her to have, when I became a public school teacher early in my career, I had a college degree. I had to have a college degree. And then I very quickly got a master's degree, because to be, a top teacher in the public school system, you have to be credentialed, you have to be degreed. And I spent a lot of money going to college and getting all those degrees. And then I want to be paid appropriately. And I'm going to kind of step aside and say my own opinion is that none of our educators are paid enough for the amount of work that we ask them to do. And then we look at our early educators, and we would like, in a best case scenario, for these people to have degrees too, but they're not making, in some cases a teacher's aide in a childcare setting is maybe making just barely above minimum wage. And so we want them to be doing this most important interaction. We want them to be working with our babies at the most important time in their lives for brain development, but it's really tough to balance that out with the fact that a lot of these folks are not making the money to reflect the fact that what they're doing is the most important brain development in a child's life.
If we care about our kids, that is certainly an area of our society where we should be placing money.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kate, one last question. Can you really teach somebody who's under five to read?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, definitely. I see little ones all the time who are under five and who are reading. And I talk to friends who are kindergarten teachers or VPK teachers, and they have little ones come into their classroom that are definitely, maybe they're not yet reading, Tolstoy or even Harry Potter yet at that age, but they're definitely coming in with their favorite Dr. Seuss book.
They can identify the letters of the alphabet. Yes. And they can identify numbers.
Yep. Yes, they can at that age. They're smart.
Simple words.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, they can. That's not something, if you have a little one and they're not reading at 4 years old, or they're not reading at 5 years old yet, they can't pick up a book and read it to you, that's okay, because we develop at different rates. But if you're exposing them to that, some of them certainly can. That's not unheard of at all. The hope is that by the time they get to kindergarten, can they identify their letters? Can they identify their numbers? Can they recognize, some of their sight words? So some of those linking words that they've seen over and over again, hopefully by then. And those are the things that we want them to be able to do when they get into school.
I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but so for parents who are listening, mm-hmm. How can they get in touch, and what else would you like to tell us about early learning and Thrive by Five?
Sure. Anyone who's looking to learn more, I would encourage you to reach out to your local Early Learning Coalition. So my colleagues over in Hillsborough County, they do a fantastic job, and you can go to their website. You can go to our website. ThriveByFivePinellas.net has a lot of this information up. And, the Early Learning Coalitions really focus on the learning part, the educational piece of early childhood. Thrive by Five is really about community, and it's about all of us working together. It's about our business partners. It's about our health partners, all of us wrapping our arms together, our elected officials and our policymakers, all of us understanding how important our little ones are. And so anyone who's interested in being a part of that, if you're listening, you're part of our community. And I'd love for you to reach out. If you're listening and you're like, I want to be a part of making our community better for little ones, you know, I can give you my email address, or it's on the website is probably the easiest way to look it up. If you go to thrivebyfivepinellas.net or the Early Learning Coalition, you can find out how to get in touch with us, and we'd love to have you as a part of the conversation.
Well, Kate Bauer-Jones, thanks a lot for coming by.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. And Kate is with Thrive by Five Pinellas. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And in just a moment, we're going to talk about possible changes to the Affordable Care Act. From Oliver Mitsukudzi, you're listening to 88.5 FM. The Trump administration has released a final rule that clears the way for expansion of so-called association health plans, which are exempt from critical insurance safeguards. And many association health plans likely will pursue strategies that are carefully designed to keep people with pre-existing conditions from buying policies. So we're going to talk about this next with Elliot Fishman, Senior Director of Health Policy for Families USA. And Elliot, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Great to be on.
So Elliot, these are the proposed changes, or some of the proposed changes that the Trump administration has promised. They say they're going to make health care cheaper and more affordable and available to more people. That was the promise from President Trump during the campaign. Is this expansion of so-called association health plans, is that on the way to doing that?
So the only sense in which that is true is there will be plans that are calling themselves health insurance, which will have kind of cut rate premiums. But this is very much a buyer beware situation, because we actually lived through this, and particularly in Florida lived through this before the passage of the Affordable Care Act and before its rules went into effect a few years ago. And there were a lot of these so-called association health plans around that were fraudulent. Actually, there were federal and state prosecutions under the RICO statute, which is kind of a classic statute for going after organized crime syndicates, that went after essentially fake business associations that were out there selling junk insurance that fell outside of federal or state regulation and then would disappear with people's premium money and not actually pay for anybody to get health care. And that is exactly the scenario that we are concerned is opened up by this expansion once again of this association health plan framework.
All right. So my understanding is that these association healthcare plans, they're targeted towards small businesses, self-employed, and freelancers. Is that right?
That's right. So this is what's called in technical terms the non-group market. That it does include small businesses, which are called in insurance terms small groups, and then also self-employed and other people who are buying insurance as individuals. That one of the key elements of the Affordable Care Act was to take that market, which was kind of a Wild West, and put some basic parameters around it, such as that plans could not discriminate either in terms of offering coverage or in terms of premiums against people with pre-existing conditions, that they had to cover a set of common benefits called essential health benefits, and that the prices that they could charge were structured and regulated, and people with middle incomes or low incomes got subsidies. What this regulation is doing is creating a kind of a shadow market for people in that non-group market that exists outside of that those structures and regulations. And notably, these plans will not have to cover a uniform set of benefits. The way in which they represent what they cover and what they don't cover is not regulated. So there is a real fear that people won't know what they're buying. They can try to avoid covering older people by being selective in what geographies, what towns they're offering coverage in. And, you know, I think this is of particular concern for your listeners and for the state of Florida, because that market of small businesses and self-employed and small proprietors is bigger in Florida than it is in any state in the country. So this has a big effect in Florida, and it can be hard to distinguish the legitimate offerings from the scams. That historically was a big problem, and we're really concerned this is going to come back with a vengeance.
We're talking with Elliot Fishman. He's Senior Director of Health Policy at Families USA. He's based in Washington, D.C. Families USA is a nonprofit that advocates for healthcare consumers across the nation. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You know, Elliot, I remember the debate over the Affordable Care Act, and people were saying, look how thick it is and how many pages it was. And it was a lot of pages, but it was double-spaced, and it only took up maybe a third of each page. It didn't take up the whole page. I was looking at my health care plan a few months ago, and it is 100 pages long. It's mostly single-spaced. It would take me a week to read it. I'm talking about the private healthcare plan that we get here at the radio station. Mm-hmm. For an individual to look at a healthcare plan to figure out whether or not it discriminates against pre-existing conditions, or whether or not it drives up, they can discriminate against people who are sick. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the existing private health insurance plans are really hard to read. Would you agree?
I totally agree. And, you know, for people who work at a large employer, typically there's a human resources department or the equivalent of a human resources department that is trying to do that job, right? And
yeah, you've got a full-time person or a full-time department doing that job, explaining right. healthcare to the employees.
And looking out for the employees, right? And making sure that this is not some sort of a fly-by-night scammer who they're buying insurance from. Here's the good news. the good news is that the individual and small business offerings that are available through the Affordable Care Act on healthcare.gov are still going to be there, right? So the concern is that these offerings are going to be out there marketing themselves to people through other online insurance sites, and that people won't know what they're getting. But you can still go to healthcare.gov and know that you're getting a federally and state regulated uniform product that is going to cover a core set of health insurance benefits and cannot discriminate on not only on the basis of pre-existing conditions, but based on gender, is not going to, fly off with your premium money to someplace that doesn't have an extradition treaty, which is really the kind of thing that was going on in this association health plan space before, and we're worried it's going to happen again.
Are these association health plans, are they regulated by state insurance commissioners? So
there is some space for state insurance commissioners to regulate them. Not as robustly as the federal government can regulate them, and we're concerned that this new federal regulation that the administration announced this week leaves the door open to the federal government pulling the rug out from under state insurance commissioners. But I would say that it's, again, because this is so big in Florida, this is just a big part of the Florida economy, that it's something for people to think about, not only as individuals purchasing insurance, but as people who are going to be voting for both executive branch and legislative elections, that you should be asking about how the state is going to take on what's essentially a new regulatory responsibility because the federal government is pulling back on regulation. And I think that is really kind of ground zero for what happens next, is how aggressively state insurance departments try to weed out the scammers and really keep this at least somewhat reliable part of the health insurance system.
All right, so watch out for these association healthcare plans. Be very careful with them. If your employer or if you as a freelancer try to go with one of these plans. Elliot, I want to ask you about something slightly different. It's still about the Affordable Care Act, but here in Florida, our Attorney General, Pam Bondi, has joined in a lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. And I think the lawsuit is headed by the state of Texas, but our Attorney General has joined in this lawsuit. If the Trump administration, as I read, is not going to defend the ACA in court. So if this lawsuit is successful, what's the implication if these states that are suing against the ACA, what's the implication for healthcare consumers?
So the first thing to say is that the lawsuit's in the first stage of a federal judicial process that will probably take some time to play out. So if the lawsuit is successful, it is challenging the whole Affordable Care Act. So all, I think, particularly of the subsidies that people have been taking advantage of, people who are middle income or lower income, in those marketplace products, those healthcare.gov products, would go away if the lawsuit is successful. And those have made a big difference in Florida. So I think these insurance protections that we've been talking about in the context of association health plans, they would go away too, and that is of great concern. But subsidy money that people have been using through premium tax credits that have been bringing down the cost of insurance and making it more affordable would go away too. It really is, to me, shocking and irresponsible that the Florida Attorney General, there's no state where more people are using those subsidies than in Florida, and that a Florida Attorney General would jeopardize them in that way out of what I think is just partisanship is really a grave threat to a lot of her own constituents. And I am just separate from my role at Families USA, just as somebody who votes and expects elected officials to look out for my interests and my community's interests. Like I'm just my breath is taken away by how irresponsible that is. But that lawsuit is going to its first steps in July, and will play out over the course of months at the very least. I'll say that I see it as legally a long shot, to say the very least. And it's to me as significant just in terms of clarifying the ideological position of both the state attorneys general and the Trump administration, that whatever they may say about believing in protections for people with pre-existing conditions, when push comes to shove, here's a lawsuit that is challenging them, and they are, just to clarify how extraordinary this is, the lawsuit is against the federal government, right? If you look at that suit, it is these attorneys general suing the federal Secretary of Health and Human Services.
And the Trump administration is not going to defend the federal government.
Right.
It is weird.
So they're getting sued and they are joining the side of the people who are suing them. That never happened. Right. That is. And in fact,
well, that's why I wonder if you say it may not go anywhere. Well, then who's left to defend it? who's going to defend protection for people who have pre-existing conditions if the Trump administration is not going to do it?
So some Democratic attorneys general and we have been very involved in this at Families USA were able to intervene in the suit and say, this would be terrible for people in our state, and are stepping up to defend this. And we wrote a amicus brief. I think it's very notable that the big national health insurance lobby wrote an amicus brief defending the Affordable Care Act. This is, just to be clear, this is not like the insurance industry driving Pam Bondi and other attorneys general to do this. The insurance industry is on the other side. So this is really just about a extreme ideological agenda against pre-existing condition protections and against what's seen as kind of a legacy of the Obama administration. But meanwhile, every big provider association, so hospitals, physicians of various specialties, the whole health insurance industry, right, the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, the America's Health Insurance Plan Lobby, certainly Families USA, other consumer organizations, the American Cancer Society, American Heart, like the whole universe of healthcare is stepping in to try to defend what the Trump administration is in a very unprecedented way, refusing to defend.
All right.
and actually, the senior Department of Justice career attorney on this resigned in protest. He couldn't believe that they would refuse to defend them.
Our guest is Elliot Fishman. He's senior director of health policy at Families USA, which is a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C., that advocates for healthcare consumers across the nation. Elliot, let's take a few phone calls. Terry in St. Pete has a question. Terry, what's your question?
Well, a couple of years ago, I stood with Families USA and dozens of other people from around the country who had success stories from the Affordable Care Act. We stood on the steps of the Supreme Court when oral arguments were made in front of the court in support of the Affordable Care Act. And my question, well, two questions. The first one is about this suit that the Justice Department is presenting. If the Supreme Court has already ruled that the Affordable Care Act is lawful, which they did several years ago, how can they, I mean, how does the suit go anywhere? How is that nothing but a frivolous lawsuit meant to do nothing but clog up the courts and make political noise? And my second question is these junk insurance policies that you talked about at the top of your segment, isn't the existence of those going to drive up costs of insurance policies for the rest of us? If a whole bunch of people flood to these really cheap garbage policies, are the other insurance companies going to start hiking our rates because they don't have the health people to balance those of us that are older and have more health needs?
Okay, Terry, I'm glad you asked those questions. Those are good questions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right. So, Elliot, what would you say?
So, on the first question, fundamentally, it is a frivolous lawsuit, and that point is exactly on point. Here is the hook that they are trying to put this on. In the tax bill that passed a few months ago, the penalties for people not purchasing insurance, called the individual mandate, were repealed as part of that tax bill starting next year. And the claim is that that somehow fundamentally makes the rest of the bill unconstitutional. It doesn't really make any sense. And clearly Congress felt that in preserving in a very public way, we all remember it, right? Congress preserved the Affordable Care Act last year and also took away this individual mandate penalty. Clearly, Congress felt the whole thing holds together. And the fact is, it is moving forward. We're all here talking about how it's going to move forward next year. So I do think it's fundamentally frivolous, but it's going to a very partisan judge in the first stage. It bears watching and monitoring. That's the first thing I'd say. And the second thing that I'd say is it just is ideologically clarifying. Right, it just shows the depth of hyper-partisan opposition to basic insurance protections that we're dealing with, that the Trump administration, Department of Justice, is not defending itself in a lawsuit because it is so deeply against the protections that are at issue.
Mm. And what about his second point, that if these association health plans come into being and they kind of take over a good chunk of insurance, will it drive up costs considering that they don't really cover that much?
100%. And actually, I mean, it's just math, right? If you are pulling people who are relatively healthy and maybe therefore more sensitive to the kind of top line premium and less concerned about reading the fine print about what this thing is actually going to cover, and you're pulling those people out of the market, and the people who are reading the fine print because they have significant health issues or who are discriminated against in the association health plan environment are left in healthcare.gov plans, that is 100% going to drive up premiums in that market. It's going to destabilize it. And that is a very serious concern. That being said, those plans are still available for people who have middle and lower incomes. They're still going to receive premium tax credits. And I don't want to, in expressing concerns about this, give people the impression that those healthcare.gov plans are going away.
All right, so Obamacare, the ACA, healthcare.gov still exists.
Right.
All right. Elliot Fishman is our guest. He's Senior Director of Health Policy at Families USA. Lots of emails. David writes this. One thing I think is funny is how Trumpsters like to say, would you like this country to be like Europe regarding immigration, healthcare, et cetera? And I say soundly, yes. Countries like Germany, France, and the UK are in better shape than the US, in my opinion. We need a national healthcare system now, Medicare for all, writes David. And somebody who's anonymous writes, my man Trump. Exclamation point, cheering on the actions of President Trump. So let's go back to the phones. We're going to go right, and thanks to James Lyles. He's our phone producer today. Let's go to John in Port Richey. John, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, a couple of things. First, real quick, which may or may not answer this question. Isn't that using the courts to legislate things by what Trump is doing? And isn't that what the conservatives always yell at the liberals doing about activist courts? Setting legislation. But my question here is, something I always heard here on the conservative side is that got to allow insurance companies to sell insurance across state lines. Now, I know they can already do that. Now, my question is, and maybe you can correct me if my thought is incorrect on this, that really what that means, selling insurance across state line is that insurance companies can go to the state that has the lowest amount of regulations, set up shop there, and then sell those low-rate plans to every other state, basically undermining each state's regulation. Is that true? Or if they set up a shop in a state that has a low regulation and they want to sell it to Florida or a state with a higher regulation, they have to abide by all those state regulations. You know what I mean? So I'm thinking it's a way for companies to get the least possible stuff they can put in a plan, because if they come to one state and they say you have to have A, B, C, D, and E in there, and they go to another state and they say, oh, you only need A, B in there, they go to the state that says they only need A, B, and then they sell it to the state only having A, B, even though if you set up in that state, you'd have to sell it with A, B, C, D, and E.
Yeah, all right, John, thanks. Does thanks a lot sense? For the question. Elliot?
Am I right in that thinking? That's my question.
So you're definitely right that that's what that kind of weird talking point about selling insurance across state lines, that's what it would lead to.
Yeah, okay.
The assurance that I can give you
market.
Is pretty tentative, which is that in this regulation, they did not what's called preempt state regulatory authority. So Florida and other state insurance departments still have the ability to regulate these plans. They left the option open to do that at some point in the future. And that it, for exactly the reasons that you described, that kind of race to the bottom and you would just sell insurance from the state that had the weakest regulations, that is something to be very seriously concerned about.
Well, Elliot Fishman of Families USA, is there anything else you'd like to add to this? Or if not, how can people find out more?
So our website, familiesusa.org, has a lot of information in general about the latest around healthcare and the latest around health insurance coverage. And we are always happy to have people looking for information on that website and getting involved.
Elliot Fishman, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. That's Elliot Fishman. He is Senior Director of Health Policy at Families USA. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for Midpoint. And on Midpoint, Shelley and Lynn are going to be talking about something that we talked about heavily yesterday, and that is the refugee crisis here in the U.S. Last night, several of the networks went around and asked President Trump supporters what they thought of the children who are being separated from their parents. And this is what Trump supporters told MSNBC and CNN about children being separated from their parents.
When a person goes, robs a bank, he's separated from his family anyway. Same as the people coming in this country. I'm an immigrant myself. I came here in 2000. And when we immigrated, we came here legally.
Our family means a lot to us, so we have to do it. I see you getting emotional. Why is that?
Because he doesn't... I just... tries so hard and so many people are so down on him.
My God, won't someone please care for the children? Well, there's children. Wait, if I get arrested, my kids aren't going to see me for a while either.
These people that we have coming across the border illegally are breaking the rules. Oh, I have no feelings for them at all. Now, when you have a bad guy coming across, kidnapping a kid and trying to come across, I don't buy that.
How many of these do you think could be bad guys?
I don't really know, but there's a lot of people being hurt by bad guys coming into this country.
Quit trying to make us feel teary-eyed for the children. Yes, I love children a great deal, but to me, it's up to the parents to do things rightfully and legally.
Trump supporters last night defending the separation of children from their parents. That's going to be one of the topics coming up in the next hour right here on WMNF in Tampa. Stay tuned for the news.